You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 24th of April 2023 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up is Sudan on the brink of civil war. As the US and other countries evacuate their citizens from Khartoum, we examine a conflict between two generals who have no appetite for stopping. Also coming up, the world waits for Ukraine's counter-offensive. We'll ask when it will come and whether Kyiv can make a decisive difference. Plus, my studio guest, Terry Stiasny, will join me to look at the Monday papers. Hello, Terry. What have you found?
Well, yes, Emmanuel Macron has been chatting to French newspaper readers on the first anniversary of his re-election. There have been some grim discoveries in Kenya regarding the members of a cult. And is Britain suffering from country embarrassment? There's a spate of articles with Britain seeing ourselves as other people in Europe might see us.
Thank you so much, Terry. Looking forward to it. All that, plus we flex our muscles as Croatia's so-called Be Manly movement emerges. And we explore a new wave of fashion soft power potential as Louis Vuitton signs a deal with the South Korean Tourist Board. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. Australia is to spend up to $12 billion to buy longer-range missiles to counter the growing threat from China. South Korea has reinstated Japan to its white list of preferred trading partners. And Taiwan's Starlux will begin its Airbus A350 service to Los Angeles later this week. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the citizens of the US, UK, France and Germany, as well as the likes of the Netherlands and Italy, have been evacuated from Sudan as fears grow of a threat of civil war. More than 400 people are now known to have died in the fighting between the Sudanese armed forces of Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and those of his rival, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemedti. Well, I'm joined now by Sir Alex Vines, who's director of the Africa Programme at Chatham House. A very good morning to you, Sir Alex.
Good morning.
There's been a weekend of very fast-moving events. Could you just bring us up to date with it, please?
So Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates and various other Gulf states, Egypt, have all evacuated their people. They did it through the port of Port Sudan. They drove their nationals from Khartoum, the capital, down to the coast. You've also then had the United States, the UK, France, you mentioned Italy, a number of other European countries also evacuating their diplomatic staff. So it's mostly been focused on embassies, although the Saudis because they were taking people out by ship, that there were civilians too. But there are still many citizens stroke nationals of foreign countries that are lying low. And waiting for a broader humanitarian evacuation, but who knows when that will be.
This marked an enormous step up this weekend, didn't it? That people were aware that what was happening in Sudan was dangerous and could go become even more serious. But the fact that everybody decided to go all at once, what does that suggest about what the world thinks is going to happen in Sudan?
I think people are pretty pessimistic at the moment that they see the situation of Sudan as moving towards a civil war and that this might be one of the last windows to get diplomatic staff out. Diplomats are saying that they thought their staff were more at risk than citizens, but I don't know how they would measure that. I just think that probably logistically it was easier to focus on the diplomats than trying to congregate broader citizens across Khartoum and other cities and locations of Sudan.
Alex, just remind us that this was not too long ago a country en route to civilian rule, and now we talk about civil war. What happened in between?
Well, this is a raw power struggle between two generals. You've mentioned them, Burhan and Hemedti. And it was meant to be a roadmap towards civilian rule, We were moving very close to that agreement. It was a response to a coup that had happened in October 2021. General Bohan had staged a coup at that point, ending a civilian process. And so this was returning to that trajectory. Unfortunately, I think between these two generals is a raw power struggle, which at the heart of it is the issue of security sector reform. The rapid support forces, which are led by General Hemeti, did not want a rapid reintegration into the Sudan armed forces. They wanted a process over a decade. And then what the media hasn't really been talking about is that the hand of people supporting the former president who was deposed some years ago in another coup, General al-Bashir, they have been playing a role in this. And it is noticeable that General al-Bashir seems to have been released in prison in a jailbreak organized by the rapid support forces yesterday, from what I can see from news reports.
So what could that mean?
Well, it feeds into this depressing scenario of a civil war with a lot more bloodshed. What's new in Sudan is that the focus of fighting is in Khartoum. Previously, historically, this has been a core periphery issue. So, for example, the region of Darfur that borders onto Chad was a hotspot focal point of violence and fighting. Khartoum historically has been fairly immune to this. Not this time. The focus, central point of fighting is Khartoum itself.
There is therefore the suggestion that this could spread right across the country. I mean, this is Africa's third largest nation. If this country descends into civil war, how long a process are we looking at until it ends? I mean, we're even asking before it ends, before it begins. But there's that sense of, are we looking at a civil war that could last months, years?
Good question. Very difficult to answer that question. You're absolutely right. It's Africa's third largest country. It has seven neighbours to it. They all have their interests in Sudan. They all would like an end result that's a little bit different than their neighbor. And so everybody is pulling on the edges of Sudan in different directions. That also complicates things. I am worried that some of the key players have closed down their embassies in Khartoum. Not Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, but also the Troika, UK, US, Norway. That means that there's less leverage also on both the generals. And I think that means that there's more room just to focus on kind of a civil war stroke armed violence at the moment. The constraining forces to try and find a humanitarian truce seem to have been reduced, I think, in the short term by the withdrawal and closure of embassies and good offices in the country itself.
This is tragically another example of... it's been written about it. There's an article in The Guardian that suggests that this is a grim procession of Arab states that over the past 10 years have overthrown dictators only to see hopes for democracy dashed. I mean, when you look at the wider picture, it does follow a very sad pattern in some places, doesn't it?
Well, you know, the African continent itself, if you widen the lens, is you know, a massive part of geography. It can swallow up the United States, Europe, India, all in the same geography. So, this is a massive continent of which different things are occurring. And so there are democratic advances as well as democratic retreats. And definitely Sudan is a very depressing one and one of those of retreat. I can give some other examples. Zambia, Malawi, for example, further south, where there have been advances, for example. So this is really complicated. But the problem for Sudan is that it has been in a kind of fit start process of trying to move back to through a transitional process to civilian rule. But it does show the power of personality politics. And at the end of the day, I think fundamentally the dispute here was over security sector reform and the integration of the rapid support forces, which was formerly a militia in Darfur called the Janjaweed, to be integrated into the Sudan armed forces. So I think that was the fault line that broke into the violence that we saw some 9 days ago or 10 days ago.
What about international players? There's suggestion that Russia's Wagner group at least might have been fueling the fire here.
Well, Wagner is there, and they've been providing some support, not particularly successfully. I think that they are one factor amongst many. I think it would be unwise to be too reductionist and blame what's going on in Sudan on a foreign force. This is clearly a lot more about Sudanese politics, but no doubt Wagner stirs the pot and looks for opportunity. They have historically been unsuccessful in Sudan, although the Russian relationship with Sudan is a long and deep one.
And finally, neighbours, international repercussions of having a war in Sudan are what?
Well, already there are the border with Chad has been closed. There have been many Sudanese who have fled across to neighbouring Chad. The region has tried to mediate. There are three presidents, Djibouti, Kenya, and South Sudan, who have offered mediation efforts. The Arab League has also offered to mediate. The African Union, the continental body, is also looking at what it can do and has issued statements. The statements are getting stronger, telling the generals to focus on humanitarian needs and to stop fighting. And so you can see the politeness in the statements is kind of melting away. But I tend to think there's going to be more fighting before we reach any sort of truce. Basically, the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, each faction of the military is looking for an advantage before they then agree to a ceasefire or truce.
Sir Alex Vines, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. It's 9:13 a.m. in Minsk and 7:13 a.m. here in London. You're with The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle Radio. Now, when is Ukraine's much-anticipated spring counteroffensive going to happen? There's been expectation and suggestion of it for weeks, with Western powers looking to see their support in terms of training and weapons paying off in pushing back the Russian invaders. I'm joined by Mark Galeotti, who's a Russia analyst and the author of The Weaponization of Everything, a field guide to the new way of war. Mark, welcome back to Monocle Radio.
Hello, good to be here.
Very good to have you. Now, so what could a counteroffensive look like?
Well, if we're seeing something happening now, it will probably be a whole variety of relatively smaller probing attacks. The point is that clearly the Ukrainians are hoping to be able to use the tanks that the West has finally provided to be a sort of armoured spearhead, but they're not yet ready. Many of them haven't yet been delivered, the training hasn't been completed, so they're not really going to be usable until the early summer. So if we're going to see an offensive now, it's going to be smaller scale, just really testing out where the potential soft spots in the Russian defences are.
So there's a suggestion already, though, that there are lots of small pushes happening.
Yeah, and some, probably most of these are actually diversionary. They're really intended to keep the Russians guessing. You know, we've heard about them crossing the river into occupied, what was generally occupied territories in the south and so forth. But as I say, I think at present, we're not really seeing signs of a truly serious offensive happening. This is actually very much to try and get the Russians to disperse their forces and essentially see if they make the kind of mistakes that they made last year, which allowed the Ukrainians to make some very major gains, by basically focusing all their forces in one area and thus allowing the Ukrainians to make progress elsewhere.
Just tell us a little bit about what we've mentioned just briefly beforehand. That this is the moment when, in theory, the extra training and support comes into effect, and when governments will be looking to see if the commitment that they have offered to Ukraine actually is manifests itself.
Yes, it's rather depressing that one of the phrases that kept coming up in some recent conversations I had in Washington was return on our investment, which is, as I said, perhaps a slightly depressing way of thinking about it, but very much this is the case. NATO decided to send a lot more kit over, and the payoff is that they're hoping that this will allow the Ukrainians to, in this spring and summer campaign season, make some kind of serious gains, which possibly will start shifting the perspective in Moscow, getting Putin more willing to talk peace on some kind of meaningful level. Of course, this is a gamble. It may well not work, and the recent intelligence leaks we had from the Americans suggest that in their internal debate, the intelligence agencies over there are frankly quite downbeat. But the point is that if it doesn't have a success, it's going to be a lot harder to keep the Western coalition in support of Ukraine active and enthusiastic.
Well, indeed, what happens if that does come to pass, that Ukraine doesn't capitalise on everything that, well, dare I say it in inverted commas, what you described as the investment made by other countries. If it doesn't make decisive action against Russia, what will that mean for other countries, whether they will still wish to help Ukraine?
Well, I mean, look, the moral case will be absolutely the same. And also, we really shouldn't underestimate President Zelensky's capacity to cajole, flatter, and generally sort of manipulate the West and Western leaders into support. He has proven to be quite extraordinarily effective at that. So, look, I don't think we're going to see some kind of massive collapse. What we're going to see instead is likely to be a slow creeping Ukraine fatigue. People beginning to question whether or not this actually is going to work.
Just tell us a little bit about the fact that we are pegging our hopes, dare I say it, or marking the so-called spring pushback. But is that a realistic focus? Because the war, it is expected, is to last much, much longer. And Ukraine, no matter how much extra resources is given, is unlikely to enjoy a decisive victory overnight this spring.
Exactly. It's not going to be some kind of grand victory which sees the Russians being swept out of all the occupied territories. Instead, what we've got to realise is to a considerable extent, this is a war being fought between President Putin's ears. You know, at present, the thing is, he feels that if he can just make this war last long enough, the West will lose its willingness to support Ukraine, and Ukraine will lose its capacity to continue fighting. Now, both of those are rather questionable assumptions, but you know, basically, he believes what he has to believe because he needs to think that he can gain some kind of victory out of this. The idea is that if actually the Ukrainians can make some kind of significant gains, particularly in the south, if they can, for example, cut off the so-called land bridge to Crimea, which will make supporting Crimea much, much harder, much, much more expensive, then they begin to make it harder for Putin to continue to tell himself that time is on his side. So, I mean, when it comes down to it, all wars are political acts. And so this is very much a way in which actually Ukrainian military success can possibly and hopefully have a disproportionate political impact.
Tell us a little bit about what Russia has got up its sleeve to counteract this. I mean, there are plenty of reports that its reserves are being depleted.
Yes, they raised about 300,000 extra troops in October or so of last year by this partial mobilization of reservists. And these troops, you know, many of them were really not very enthusiastic, not very good. But nonetheless, you know, they were warm bodies and they addressed the main need of the Russian military. But of course, yes, they have been taking casualties, as sadly have been the Ukrainians. There's still, it seems to be, enough of them to mount a convincing defense. What there aren't really is enough for a major new Russian offensive. So, you know, essentially the Russians, for all that they're hammering away at Bakhmut, are basically down in much more kind of defensive mode. They have more escalatory options, but the thing is, they all have massive potential political price tags. Putin could send in his conscript army. That's about 180,000 of them, but he knows that that'll be very unpopular with the families back home. He could launch another mobilization wave and get more troops. But again, I mean, the last time that happened, more Russians left the country than actually ended up being enlisted. You know, he can do quite a few things, but each of them has a risk, and Putin is very, very risk averse. So at present, I think they're just digging in and hoping that they can weather whatever storm the Ukrainians send their way.
Do we want to turn now to the continuing struggle to make the sanctions imposed on Russia have some bite? And there's growing concern that Turkey is playing an increasing role in laundering money and key goods, such as oil, in order to help both Russia and Belarus in the conflict against Ukraine. I'm delighted to say Ruth Michelson, a journalist based in Istanbul, joins us to talk about this. Good morning, Ruth.
Morning, Emma.
So what exactly is getting through?
Well, we've seen that there is some reporting from more of these leaked intelligence documents from the US talking about for Belarus and Russia, in the case of Belarus, the idea that Turkish companies were buying sanctioned goods and reselling them on the European market, and also in the opposite direction, that Turkish companies were reselling goods from Europe to Russia. We have seen since the start of the Ukraine invasion that there has been a huge rise in the trade between Turkey and Russia. Most of the trade has been Turkish companies selling things to Russia, and there has also been a rise in Russian companies setting up in Turkey. What's of concern to the US increasingly over time has been so-called dual-use items, things that could have a military application. And we saw that earlier this month, there were US sanctions on two Turkish electronics firms, which have been allegedly buying things like computer chips, and shipping them to Russia. And this has been of increasing concern to the US, and that's the kind of goods that they've been cracking down on recently.
There's also the issue of oil as well, that if Russian tankers transport their oil to refineries in Turkey, you mix the oil together and then you can export it absolutely anywhere. And there is allegations that an awful lot of the petrol that we have in our cars at the moment is still Russian. I mean, what can be done here?
Turkey has known since the start of the invasion that it has been under increasing scrutiny, particularly by the US, on this issue. There's a very prominent Turkish bank, Halk Bank, that is still in court in the US right now, accused of helping Iran evade sanctions. So this has been of concern since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What the US has done in response, and to some extent the EU, but this has primarily been spearheaded by the US, is to have officials come to Turkey and to make clear that Turkey is under enormous scrutiny, and essentially to try and give the impression, at least, that if Turkey or Turkish companies want to do things to evade sanctions, that they're going to have to, that doing anything extremely large is going to be difficult. But at the same time, as you point out, with accusations around oil and large goods, there are some things that are getting through. And so all that can be done, it seems, at the moment is increasing that scrutiny, increasing that pressure from the US. But, that's also something that's political, that Turkey's willingness to comply in some cases depends on politics. And in other cases, for example, when we look at Turkish banks getting rid of the use of the MIR payment system, that's about also Turkey's willingness to engage in international banking systems, in the international system in general. And so using that pressure is normally what has been effective.
Ruth Michelson, based in Istanbul, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. And thanks to Mark Galliotti. Still to come on today's programme.
Why are groups of men spending their Saturdays kneeling in city squares across Croatia? I'm Monocle's man in the Balkans, Guy Delaunay, and I'll be answering this riddle, no knee pads required.
You're listening to The Globalist. Right, let's continue with today's newspapers on The Globalist. I'm delighted to say in the studio, Terry Stiassny, political journalist and author, and the woman who's done the heavy lifting on looking at all the papers this morning. Thank you for joining us. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Good to have you with us. Let's have a look at... Le Parisien has got... did something rather clever yesterday. It sat Emmanuel Macron down, the French president, 1 year exactly to the day since he was re-elected. And let the public ask him questions. Now, this is quite a good thing for Macron, given the fact that his reputation since day one has been Jupiter, the man who sees himself above everything.
Yes, but I actually think Macron, he does have that reputation, but actually when he does get the chance to talk to real people, which perhaps he doesn't do often enough, he often comes out of it quite well. I remember in his first election campaign, he was talking to some striking workers and got into a really long discussion with them about, you know, the rights and wrongs of their strike. And then also he was interviewed once by a group of young people with disabilities and was actually able to laugh at himself quite a lot. So, you know, maybe he should do this a bit more, because this is quite interesting, particularly when he's talked to the readers of Le Parisien here. And every French newspaper has been picking up on this, because he is trying to sort of damp things down a bit. He is suggesting that perhaps he should have done a bit more to prepare the ground, particularly on the pension reform. He's saying that he wants to start having, you know, a public debate about it, and perhaps he should have been more present to try and talk this through and try and discuss things with people. Now, you could argue it's a bit late just to start sort of talking to everybody and trying to persuade them that French people should perhaps retire a bit later than they would. But it's interesting that now he really sort of says, well, I need to engage with people and I need to talk to people. And he's actually tackled about, you know, how he communicates. And he's sort of said, yeah, in some cases, OK, I was wrong to have been critical of people who didn't have jobs, or, you know, and trying to overcome some of his missteps in communication in the past.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because of the point of Macron, seen from the outside, is that he's an incredibly serious politician who takes serious issues seriously. And he is always a man who reasons and who argues, an incredibly French thing. But the fact is he's now, dare I say it, well into his second term, and only now does he recognise it. He needs to make an emotional connection with his voters.
Yes, I mean, that exactly. But he does draw a line. I mean, this is one of the quite interesting things here. And people are talking about, you know, these sort of concerts of casseroles. I don't know the exact English translation. People banging saucepans.
People have been banging their pans.
To protest against him. And he doesn't like. You see, he does like a good argument. He does not like people banging their saucepans about him. He says, when you've got people who are there only to cover and to obscure your voice, you know, that's not a contest, that's incivility, and people need to stop doing that. He obviously would rather have the argument, even if belatedly. And he's talking about all sorts of other things as well, you know, renovating school buildings and immigration and police. And so, you know, it's a really, really wide-ranging interview. And the question is whether this will do enough to sort of damp down the protests.
Will this actually make any difference, given the fact that A, his unpopular pension reform has already gone through. B, he's also in his second term. So basically, he is in a position of total strength in terms of pushing any ideas through.
Well, I mean, yes, maybe it's, you know, a good decision to do this after the reforms has gone through, because he's gone through all the stages of this. He's got through what he wants, OK, in the face of quite a lot of protests. But one of the interesting things, obviously, he can't run for re-election again, but he's asked about the risk of Marine Le Pen coming into power. And he says, you know, she could get into power if we don't know how to respond to the challenges that the country is facing, and if we have a habit of lying and denying reality. So he is warning about this, but saying that, you know, he doesn't think that she is going to get into power. So he is trying to look ahead to you know, what his legacy might be.
Let's look at soft power. And the United Kingdom sometimes does well in the monocle soft power list. Sometimes it doesn't. But if the articles that have appeared almost simultaneously and unconnected in the last 24 hours suggest that the UK is on the decline.
Well, yes, this is interesting. And I can sort of predict now that there's going to be a bit of some sort of an uproar within the UK responding to some of these articles. And there are two articles here. One is in Der Spiegel. It's published in the international version of the Spiegel, and presumably in the German one as well, talking about, the headline is, the UK faces a steep climb out of a deep hole, talking about food shortages, mouldy apartments, and lack of medical workers. And the article is using the collapse of the Palace of Westminster, the House of Commons and the House of Lords, which is perpetually in a state of disrepair with big chunks of stone falling off it, and using this as a metaphor for the rest of the country. And the Spiegel's London correspondent has also been around the country to Birmingham and to Blackpool, and sort of saying really what a state Britain is in terms of things like food banks and in terms of healthcare. And, you know, the article sums up at the end by talking about ambulances and strikes and saying that perhaps Britain has called 999, but nobody has yet come to help it. Which is, and you know, this is the same time there's an article in The Guardian where you would probably expect to find these kind of stories. We're talking about what they perhaps call country embarrassment. So this is like being embarrassed about your country, which is a fairly British trait as it goes. The journalist Emma Beddington, whose French in-laws arrived to visit, and saying that, you know, they missed the train, the platforms, the trains weren't working, they were worried about healthcare, and, you know, a general British sense of that people in the rest of Europe are looking at us with horror and worrying about the state of Britain.
It's an easy thing to do, to bash Britain if you're European, given Brexit, but within the context, I think what's interesting in the Spiegel article is it says, and I'll quote here, after 2 years of pandemic and a year of war, the rest of Europe isn't doing particularly well, but nowhere is the feeling of having lost the future, in inverted commas, stronger than in Britain. Apparently in 2008, when we had the banking crisis, 12% of people in the UK thought their children would be worse off. Now that number is 41%. So it appears that this problem is these problems are particularly acute here in the UK.
Yeah, and I think this is reflected in this Guardian article as well, saying that, you know, while people in France are worried about, you know, things like retirement ages and pensions, energy prices going up, food prices going up, they seem to perceive the things in Britain as being much worse, you know, for instance, not having salad on the supermarket shelves and things like that. And yes, there is a particularly British thing, and we are inclined to criticise ourselves. And there's a whole load of books coming out at the moment about why Westminster isn't working, what's gone wrong with British politics, what's gone wrong with our infrastructure. But I think, you know, more generally, politically, that is quite worrying for the government if that is the perception not only elsewhere in Europe, but in Britain as well.
Terry Stiasny, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. The time here in London is 7:32. In a moment, we hear about Croatia's hard men. But first, let's have a look at the headlines. Australia is to spend up to $12 billion to buy longer-range missiles to counter the growing threat from China. It's described as the biggest overhaul of Australian defence since World War II. The announcement follows a report which warns that Australia's geographic isolation is no longer enough to protect it in the missile age. South Korea has reinstated Japan to its whitelist of preferred trading partners. Japan's preferred trade status will cut red tape for exporters by shortening the review period for approval of strategic goods heading to the country from South Korea. The development is part of broader attempts by Seoul and Tokyo to fix diplomatic ties and Washington's efforts to create a global supply chain less reliant on China. And Taiwan's Starlux will begin its Airbus A350 service to Los Angeles this week, marking the carrier's first long-haul route. It's one of three airlines currently operating between Taipei and LA, and will join San Francisco as Taiwan's only long-haul market to have a trio of non-stop operators. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. The time in Zagreb is 8:34 a.m, 7:34 here in London. Now, since the end of last year, hundreds of Croatian men have been gathering every month to pray in support of the so-called Be Manly movement. Their wish is a controversial one, a return to traditional values such as a ban on abortions and for women to adopt a more modest lifestyle. Well, let's hear now from our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay. A very good morning to you.
Morning, Emma, and morning all.
Thank you. Now, you've been travelling through Zagreb this weekend. Did you run into any of these characters?
Yeah, they're only there on the first Saturday of every month, and I was indeed in Zagreb at the weekend, but I know where they go, these characters. They're on Trg Ban Jelačić, which is the main square in Zagreb, which is very pretty, and if you go to Zagreb, you're bound to spend some time there, because it's where a lot of the tram lines converge, although despite that, it's close to all other sorts of traffic, and you've got all these cafes lining the square, and a big space in the middle with the obligatory man on a horse in the middle of it, who happens to be Ban Jelačić, but you know, every city in ex-Yugoslavia, there's a man on a horse somewhere. But surrounding this man on a horse on the first Saturday of every month, you do have a row upon row of rather sad-looking men, if you see the photos, Emma, sort of kneeling and looking sort of demonstratively pious. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Try that with a gobful of cornflakes.
The fact is that they're looking for... and they may not seem that impressive, but what they are asking for is pretty dangerous, isn't it?
It is. It's very dangerous indeed. So basically, just to give it the lowdown, they're asking for men And this is all their definitions. This is not something, you know, that a reasonable person would suggest, but this is according to the movement itself. They want men to again become spiritual authorities in their families and witness the Catholic faith to others, in other words, to proselytize, to pass it on. And they pray for women's chastity and modest dress and behavior, for everyone to honor chastity, and they're also against abortion into the bargain, as you mentioned before. You know, and all this rather sounds like dragging women's rights back to the Stone Age, doesn't it?
It does a little bit. Is there a wider context here insofar as there's an argument that's sometimes made that post-Cold War, equality and freedom has had a bit more time to grow in the West, and there's a pretty serious game of catch-up taking place in some places?
Yeah, Croatia in some ways has been pretty good. For example, Zagreb was the first city in the region to have a large-scale pride event, and that goes off every year without need for military helicopters flying overhead, which is what I've experienced sometimes in Belgrade when they finally did start holding pride events in Belgrade. But in other respects, there are major issues in Croatia with what one could euphemistically call social conservatism. Did I say that right? Conservatism? I'm having a problem with my words this morning, Emma. But, you know, this is one of the big things. The Croat identity is tied up with its Catholicism. If you're looking at Serbia and Croatia, they're Slavic people. So in essence, racially, they're the same. The difference between Croats and Serbs is one lot are Catholic, the other lot are Orthodox. And when you had the hyper-nationalism of the 1990s, this Catholicism was, it was hyper-stimulated. It became such a key part of Croat identity that we are Catholic, the Serbs are Orthodox, the Bosniaks are Muslims. So Catholicism became a part of what we are. And you can imagine what sort of power that gave the Catholic Church.
Guy Delaunay, thank you so much for joining us. You're with The Globalist on Monocle Radio. It currently takes around three quarters of an hour to drive between the Swedish city of Malmö to the Danish capital Copenhagen. But some enthusiastic joined-up thinking is being done with plans to connect the two cities' metro systems. Well, Ilgin Karlidag is a freelance journalist and she joins me now from Malmö. Good morning, Ilgin.
Good morning.
So at the moment, just geographically, just describe how far apart these two cities are. And there's a body of water in the way, isn't there? So how is this metro system going to fix this?
Well, they're not very far apart. In fact, if you're at the beach in Malmö, you can see Copenhagen right across. Currently, the two cities are connected by the iconic Öresund Bridge, which has been popularized in Nordic Noir series. So currently, it takes about half hour, 40 minutes to get to central Copenhagen from Malmö, and from Malmö to the Kastrup Airport in Denmark, it takes only 20 minutes. So it doesn't take very long. But a potential metro system would half that. It would take 20 minutes to get to central Copenhagen from Malmö. So and the trains would leave every 90 seconds. So it would be much more frequent and the cities would become much more closer.
And it's not just the sense that you can geographically bring two places together, and it's also a rather spectacular piece of infrastructure. This would benefit both cities in what way? We have a demand for workers in Copenhagen. We have high unemployment in Malmö. Would just simply bringing a metro system to link them sort these problems out?
That I'm not quite sure of, but I would say that, you know, in terms of unemployment in Malmö, there is actually employment in Malmö, but it's for a very specific sector. Malmö's population has actually grown in recent years. It's one of the fastest growing cities in Sweden because of the IT sector and young people applying for sort of technology IT jobs. But according to the proposal to the metro system, this would be more sort of climate friendly, because the goal is to minimize the use of lorries when transporting goods. So what would happen is, if this metro is built, people would use the metro to commute, and the current sort of hard railway system that they have, the trains that we take now, would carry goods instead, transport goods. So that would minimize lorries and make it more climate friendly and more sustainable. That's one of the main goals. And what's also mentioned in the proposal is that the metro would be good in terms of scientific studies, or scientists and people who apply for research jobs could perhaps live in Malmö and then travel to Copenhagen very easily, etc.
Ilgin Kaledag, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. For more insight and analysis on the upcoming Copenhagen-Malmö metro line, sign up to our free daily newsletter, The Monocle Minute. More details can be found there. You are The Globalist. Now, tributes to the Australian performer Barry Humphries have been paid. He died this weekend, aged 89, described as one of the greatest stand-up comedians of his age, whose wider achievements in the art world as a writer, painter, actor and scholar were overshadowed by his most monstrous creations, Dame Edna Everage and Sir Les Paterson. Monocle's Andrew Muller looks back at his life.
Gough Whitlam, Prime Minister of Australia from 1972 to 1975, was a droll left-winger of Republican inclinations. In later life, Whitlam was fond of declaring that his Labour government had only bestowed one imperial honour. In 1974, Whitlam had agreed to make a cameo appearance in Bruce Beresford's film Barry McKenzie Holds His Own, a sequel to The Adventures of Barry McKenzie, also a bawdy chronicle of an unreconstructed Australian's adventures abroad. At the conclusion of Barry McKenzie Holds His Own, the eponymous hero played by Barry Crocker, later Fact Fans, the voice of the original Neighbours theme, returns to the old country in triumph, accompanied by his aunt, Edna Everage, a Wagga Wagga-born housewife, now resident in Moonee Ponds, played by Barry Humphries. The pair are greeted at the airport by the Prime Minister, played by the Prime Minister, who congratulates Barry McKenzie. Edna Everage descends in curtsy, and the rest is history. Dame Edna Everage, as she was thenceforth known, was only the most famous of the many faces of Barry Humphries. Barry Humphries was born on February 17, 1934, in Melbourne. He became entranced in his teens by Dada, the absurdist art movement which had erupted in Europe in the 1920s, but was arguably still away from reaching Australia by the 1950s. Reception to his early pranks and manifestations tended towards the bewildered. In his 20s, Humphries found a haven in Sydney's Theatreland, but his homeland, though geographically vast, was never going to be artistically big enough for him. Later, Humphries would say that living permanently in the Australia of that time would be like going to a party and dancing with your mother. Humphries arrived in London in 1959, a pathfinder for an influential and rambunctious crew of ambitious expats who, like Humphries, took themselves out of Australia but never quite took the Australia out of themselves. Clive James, Robert Hughes, Germaine Greer and Richard Neville could have come from nowhere else. Humphries was welcomed as a friend, peer and collaborator by the satirical comedy scene that gathered around Peter Cook. Humphries was a prolific and multi-talented actor, serious and silly, on stage and screen, and other things besides. Among Humphries' works of this period were scripts for a cartoon strip in Private Eye, The Wonderful World of Barry McKenzie. McKenzie had a perhaps uncomfortable amount of his author in him. It took the shock of being retrieved unconscious from a gutter in 1973 to put Humphries permanently off alcohol. Though Humphries did not play McKenzie himself, the character inspired Humphries to not only create but inhabit a series of emblematically Australian grotesques, lampooning different aspects of his country with affectionate contempt. There was, of course, Dame Edna, who blossomed into a monstrous, radiant suburban diva, forever playing dumb, forever smarter than anyone she was speaking to. Richard Gere and Lauren Bacall were just two of many celebrities reduced to bewildered props as Dame Edna terrorised chat shows as a guest.
It's beautiful, Michael. Thank you for bringing two great legends together tonight. Oh, two and a half. Sorry. I should say, two and three quarters, shouldn't I? But I also saw you in Greece in the 60s. Did anyone know that he was in Greece on the West End stage? Did he say that in his interview?
It was mentioned, yes.
Was it? Yes, but people might have missed it. I might have been going to make a cup of tea or something. But I saw you, and when I saw you in Greece playing the title role, I think it was.
Greece.
Part of Greece.
And she was no less merciless as a host.
Refuses to learn from his mistakes. That's a lovely attribute. You got into trouble saying rude things about...
I think I should have talked more about bicycles, don't you know?
Too late. But you...
I think bicycles would promise it, wouldn't it?
There's something endearing about this bumbling fellow, don't you think? I want to get back to the city of Portsmouth. Now look, you recently described Portsmouth as too full of drugs, obesity and underachievement.
Arguably.
Arguably.
Yeah, all right, which is admittedly a weasel word.
It is.
I did say that. And, of course, I want to say now to anybody who's watching from Portsmouth that, you know, I apologise for any hurt that I've caused with those words. However,
I could have been speaking about any other city.
Exactly.
Britain, couldn't you?
Exactly.
There was Sandy Stone, prissy middle-class dullard, personification of the Australia Humphreys had fled.
I went to the RSL the other night and had a very nice night's entertainment. Beryl, that's the wife, came along too. Beryl's not a drinker, but she had a shandy.
And there was, gloriously, exuberantly and revoltingly, Sir Les Paterson, Australian cultural attaché and occupant of other posts including, but by no means limited to, chairman of the Australian Cheese Board, etiquette and protocol advisor to the Australian Federal Government, and minister for the Yarts, very much spelled Y-A-R-T-Z.
Now, my mother always said, never trust a man who doesn't drink, and I don't. I like a drink. I'm not ashamed of that. As a matter of fact, you know, I'm as full as a pommy complaint box at the moment. I mean that in a very nice way, too.
So, Les, do you have any artistic leaning to yourself? I mean, do you write anything at all? Do you write...
I write the odd poem, you know? From time to time, you know, I might be anywhere. I could be at an international airport. I could be on a TV, the talk show like this with you, Mike. And all of a sudden, suddenly I feel a stanza coming up, you know? I feel the odd, you know, hexameter rising in me.
These wondrous creatures all gave Humphreys license to make jokes about and critiques of Australia that might have gotten him chased to the airport at Pitchfork Point had he made them under his own name, in his own person. And they also clearly allowed Humphreys, an aesthete and dandy who collected art and rare literature, painted landscapes, and in his private life never swore and made a point of removing his hat when ladies were present, to step several miles outside himself and perhaps see himself as the less decorous likes of Sir Les might have.
But do you get on with him? Because he's a very intelligent person. He doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he's a very... And you do all those things.
I enjoy life, and I'm not sure he does.
For all that Humphreys was widely beloved and enormously famous, it was never entirely clear where he was coming from. Conservatives and liberals all found cause over the decades to embrace or damn him and his characters. One would require only the lowliest pass in psychology from the University of Armchair to consider Humphreys' fondness for adopted personae and conclude that this was how he preferred it.
I do also sometimes feel that whatever private difficulties I might be having, and I'm not immune from those any more than any member of my audience, that once I'm on stage, I'm alone. I might be in the presence of a large audience, but
I have actually stepped onto a stage, heard a big ovation, and thought to myself, alone at last. I guess that'll be my epitaph.
Via Dame Edna and Sir Les in particular, Barry Humphreys may have done more than anyone else to promote the Australian dialect of English, an idiom as dry, rugged and quirky as the continent which produced it. Fittingly, it is an Australian word which sums Barry Humphreys up better than any other epithet. It is larrikin, generally applied to the sort of scoundrel whose mischief delights as least as much as it infuriates. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller.
My thanks to Andrew for that. You're with The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Now let's get a roundup of the latest news in the Asia-Pacific region with Monocle's Asia editor James Chambers, who joins us now from Bangkok. Hello, James.
Morning, Emma.
Good to have you with us. Let's touch briefly on the fact that there are Thai elections on the way.
That's right. I think they begin. A polling day is 3 weeks from now. So you can imagine that the electioneering and the campaigning is ratcheting up. And the posters and flyers and leafleting is everywhere.
Just tell us a little bit about the fact that the main opposition party is ruling out any cooperation with the military. But what is the status of an opposition party in Thailand at the moment?
Well, the Pheu Thai party is the main opposition, and they are forecast to win the most number of seats come election day. But it's pretty clear that no party is going to win big enough to form a government, and there'll have to be a coalition. So parties are coming under pressure now to say who they will partner up with and who they wouldn't. I guess the key question is whether you'd be willing, as an opposition party, as essentially a liberal pro-democracy party, to kind of hold your nose and go into coalition with some of the military figures who have dominated Thailand over the last 8 years and who led the coup in 2014. Pheu Thai was coming under a lot of scrutiny because there was some suggestions that they'd done a secret deal under the table that they might partner up with the generals. But now they came out over the weekend to say that they won't be doing that. And one of the reasons behind that is probably because one of the other opposition parties has been rising up and have been polling very well on the back of its very strict and very direct and very firm refusals to countenance anything to do with the coup leaders.
Let's move on to South Korea. The president is in Washington talking to Joe Biden. High on the agenda, no doubt, is North Korea and South Korea's ability to protect itself.
Yes, I think this is going to be the story that dominates the week here in Asia. President Yoon Suk-yeol has got on a plane earlier today in Seoul. He'll be arriving in Washington later, and he's going to be spending the whole week in the US. And it's the first state visit by a South Korean president since 2011. So it's a pretty big deal. The main reason for going is to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the kind of bilateral military agreement between the two nations, which was signed in the 50s after the Korean War. And sadly, you know, that military alliance is still very much in play today and has probably even, you know, only grown in significance with the North Koreans developing their own nuclear weapons. So, as you said, I think the big discussion point for Mr. Biden and Mr. Yoon will be the US's agreement to essentially come to the South Korea's defense if they are attacked, and that includes, you know, firing nuclear weapons. So a term I think we're going to hear a lot more this week is a term called extended deterrence, and I think we're all going to find out what that actually means.
Finally, tell us about the fact that we have Golden Week happening this in the next few days, and countries or places or destinations are gearing up for a huge movement of people. Explain what Golden Week is and how people are getting ready.
So, I mean, Golden Week is around Labor Day, which is, you know, a holiday all around the world. But in places like Japan and in China, workers get, you know, more than just one day off. Sometimes it's the whole week. And for China, it's one of the biggest, you know, holidays in the year. And it's a time when a lot of Chinese travel overseas. Now, you know, that hasn't been possible for the last 3 years. This is the first Golden Week where Chinese can actually leave the country. And so you have a lot of destinations around Asia who are going to be keenly watching how many Chinese actually come to visit, you know, countries like Thailand here and Hong Kong and all across Southeast Asia are very dependent on Chinese tourist money. So they'll be watching to see how many of their hotels will be full up and how many of their restaurants will be full up. I think the indication is that the Chinese are going to be back. If you look at Hong Kong, which should be one of the first cities to see this return, I think they're expecting something like 600,000 mainlanders to turn up this weekend, which is staggering when you think the city has only got 7 million people normally. So that's certainly going to be a visible arrival. But even though the demand might be there, the supply issues might be the thing that hold them back. There's still not that many flights. There's not enough staff, and costs are going up. So we'll have to wait and see.
James Chambers, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Bangkok. You're with The Globalist. Now, another dose of significant soft power of fashion is to be deployed later this month as Louis Vuitton stages a fashion show in South Korea. The aim is to boost tourism to the country and also to build on the country's love of luxury and K-pop. Well, I'm joined now by Dana Thomas, the Paris-based author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and The Future of Clothes. Good morning to you, Dana.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Delighted to have you on the programme. So just tell us, what's happening? This isn't just a show, is it? This is also a big deal with South Korean tourism.
It is a very big deal with South Korea's tourism organization, or it's called Korea Tourism Organization, and the South Metropolitan Government. They are creating content and events to promote the city throughout the next year or two. And it's a big program called Visit Korea Year. And LVMH has decided to, and Louis Vuitton has decided to be a part of this. So they're having the big show this week on the Jamsu Bridge across the Han River. And they've also launched the Louis Vuitton City Guide app about South Korea, about Seoul. And it's like a guide, but now it's an app. They used to publish them as little books, and it gives you luxury hospitality, fancy pants restaurants, must-see landmarks. All Louis Vuitton and South Korea are working together. They also just signed J-Hope, J-Hope is a South Korean musician and producer, part of the K-pop movement, and as a new house ambassador. So they're really, you know, pushing on Korea. Now, here's why. 10% of all luxury retail sales are from South Korea. And that was $16 billion worth in 2022, up 24% from the previous year. Now, of course, those numbers are all kind of inflated. When you say that, everyone keeps saying, oh, our sales are up so much right now. Well, you have to realize that that was against nothing during the pandemic. So that 24% was based on the fact that they didn't sell anything the year before. But nevertheless, it's a rising market is what the short version is. And it always has been an important market, but now it's just exploding.
And of course, if you are LVMH, you don't just have Louis Vuitton up your sleeve. You've got huge brands as well to go from it.
75 different brands. You've got Dior, you've got Kenzo, you've got Givenchy, you've got, you know, all the watch brands, Moet & Chandon Champagne, Krug Champagne. You know, it's a big thing. You know, Louis Vuitton, of course, is the cash cow for the group. It makes up the majority of its sales. But and in Asia, Louis Vuitton is still the luxury item, the status item that you want to own and you want to carry around, even if it's a little handbag to have that monogram. That 150-year-old monogram, you know, is still the number one selling item in that group.
Just briefly tell us about the LVMH is not just targeting the likes of South Korea as well. There was a meeting this weekend, wasn't there, between Bernard Arnault and the Chinese Minister of Commerce. And this is LVMH moving everywhere.
Yes. Well, I mean, China's been the biggest market for ages, as I wrote in my first book, Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. And that came out in 2007. And I talked about how China was so important and went and reported on the opening of stores, Louis Vuitton stores in China for the book. They've been banking on China for a long time. It makes up the majority of their sales, but not just theirs. Everybody's in luxury. China is a massive market. But what's interesting is LVMH is now not just targeting, you know, not just doing retail and you know, going out and selling and buying ads in magazines. They're doing deals with the governments. So he met with Wang Wentao, Chinese Minister of Commerce, at the Dior flagship on Friday here in Paris. And this comes right on the heels of President Macron's visit to China earlier this month. And, you know, they highlighted the sustainable growth of the Chinese economy and the constant dynamism of LVMH's brands in China, they said. You know, this is an important thing. You know, he's actually moving into sort of retail diplomacy, basically. And it's not the first time he's done this. You know, he did this in the United States when he worked out a deal with the state of Texas to open a factory in Texas. They got huge tax abatements for years and years and years. And President Trump went, when he was still president, and did the ribbon cutting. So this is a new way of working. I mean, it's not a new way. I'm sure he's been doing it forever, but doing it forward-facing, public-facing, saying, you know, here I am shaking hands with the commerce minister in Paris of China, and here I am shaking hands with the governor of Texas.
Dana Thomas, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist, and thanks to all my guests for today's programme, and to the producers Laura Kramer and Isabella Jewell, our researchers Helmi Pillai, and studio manager Tamsin Howard. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening. Have a great week.